Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today we'll hear a talk by Cheryl Wudunn, author with her husband, journalist Nicholas Kristof, of A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity, and, also co-written with Nicholas Kristof, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide, which is also the topic of her presentation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 23, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.N. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mike Zeleny, Associate Vice Chancellor for Research and Economic Development at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
The first Asian American Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Cheryl Wudunn, has journeyed through several industries, from banking to journalism to book writing. She's used her immense talent as a writer, speaker, and thought leader to advocate for those without the resources to advocate for themselves. She was selected as one of Newsweek's 150 Women Who Shake the World. She's helped raise awareness about the challenges facing women. Her best-selling books include A Path Appears, about spreading opportunity and making a difference in the world, and Half the Sky, about oppression of women and girls around the world. A highly successful business executive, Cheryl currently works with entrepreneurs in the media, technology, and social enterprise at Midmedia Securities, a small investment banking boutique in New York City. This evening, after her remarks, you'll have the opportunity to ask Cheryl questions. The title of this evening's presentation is Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Please join me in giving a warm Nebraska welcome to Cheryl Wudunn. Welcome.
Thank you. Wow, look at this. Thank you so much. I am just delighted to be here, and I want to thank the organizers, the E.N. Thompson Forum and the University of Nebraska, for allowing me to come on a beautiful weather day instead of the snowstorm. So thank you very much. And I love coming to Lincoln. It's my first time, and I'm very lucky. So I want to talk to you also about some topics that seem so distant. They're spiritually and physically very distant from our workaday world here. And so I appreciate that you have invited me here to talk about these issues. But there are some things that are very common, how we achieve success, the road to success. And so I do want to talk a little bit about some of those paths from remote places that also lead to success. You know, we've had some great changes in history. If you think back to the days of Alexander the Great, when it was a real achievement to kill your first man at the age of 12. And then the Middle Ages, the World Wars, we have really become a much less violent society. But there is one thing that has not made that much progress. And it is wife burnings. It is maternal mortality. It is the abuse, the hatred, and the violence against women. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of that today and about some of the ways to get out of that. So I'd like to take you to one of my favorite places, China. Let me take you to the real China. This is Dai Manju. Dai Manju was 13 years old when the story starts. She lives in a very remote part of Hebei province, 2 hours from the nearest road. She lives in a little hut with her parents, her brother, her great aunt, and they have no running water, no electricity, they have no refrigerator, no radio, no wristwatch, no bicycle, and they share this great splendor with a very large pig. Yes, a pig. And so Dai Manju was 13 years old when she was about to enter sixth grade. And her parents said, you know, Taiman Chu, you are going to be spending the rest of your life in the rice paddies, doing household chores. It costs us $13 every year to send you to school. What a waste of money. So they pulled her out of school. For Taiman Chu, that was really, she was horror-stricken because it turns out she was the best pupil in the grade, and you know what it takes to be number one. And so she was devastated. She still made the two-hour trek to school, hung out at the schoolhouse. Maybe someone would give her some books that they didn't want anymore, or some, you know, paper or pen that she, pencil she could write on. She was so poor she couldn't even afford that. So we wrote about her in the New York Times, and there was a flood of letters, many of which had donations in them for $13. And then there was this money transfer for $10,000. It was amazing. Well, we thought, this is wonderful. What generosity. We gave the money to that man in the photo. If you can see the photo again, he's the teacher right standing next to Taiman Chu. He was overjoyed. He thought, I can give not only a scholarship to Taiman Chu, I can give one to all of the girls. I can give one to the boys, too, so everyone will stay in school. I can renovate the schoolhouse. So Taiman Chu was finishing up with sixth grade when we thought, why don't we give a progress report to this donor? After all, it was just so nice of him. So we called up the donor and we said, sir, we want to thank you for your generosity. You have no idea how far $10,000 goes in poor rural China. There was a pause at the other end of the line. He said, I didn't give $10,000. I gave $100. Well, we had a problem here. Well, we looked into this, and sure enough, there was a bank clerk who had a slight problem with decimal points. Yeah. Nick and I used to joke that we were sure that during the financial crisis, he must have been transferred to the Department for Subprime Mortgages. But we really had this problem on our hands because we had just given $10,000 to this, you know, poor guy. And we didn't have the money to give it back. And so we thought about something. And so I know that there are a lot of journalism students in the audience. So for those of you there, please put this story aside. Because we're not really proud as journalists of what we did, but we're in a bind. So we knew someone, a senior official at the bank. It was Morgan Guaranty Trust Bank, which, as you happen to see, is no longer around. But, so, nothing to do with this particular $10,000, of course. But, so we called up the official, and we said, sir, we are doing a follow-up story, and on the record, we want to know, are you going to send your bankers to this remote village to get your money back and throw all these girls out of school again? Well, he didn't miss a beat. He said, on the record, under the circumstances, we are delighted to make a donation for the difference. So, thank goodness, all the kids, they were able to continue school. Taiman Chu was able to finish middle school. She went to high school. She went to vocational school for accounting. And then Taiman Chu, this is unheard of in a tiny little remote village. She went down to southern province of Guangdong to look for a job. She found a job as a, you know, in the accounting department of a factory. She got a paycheck, the first in her family. And then we actually had a natural experiment in girls' education. Because what we saw next was something remarkable. So Taiman Chu started sending money back to her home. Her parents started saving the money. Pretty soon they had enough money to build a new house. This time with electricity, with running water, a refrigerator, radio, a bicycle. The pig moved outside. It was really interesting to see that a vicious cycle had been broken and a virtuous cycle had been started. And this was going on with Taiman Chu's female classmates as well. They sent money back. Their parents actually started saving and then built houses. And sure enough, this village became much more prosperous. So you might be saying, well, of course, China was blossoming at the time. And that is true. But this village actually stood out. And it stood out because they educated the girls. In fact, the government built a road to link the village to the rest of China. And, you know, this has been repeated millions of times throughout China, throughout Asia. And it's the story of educating girls and boys as well, but focusing on making sure that the girls also stay in school because they actually can help not only educate themselves, but pay back to their village. When you gross that up, it really means GDP for the economy. It's pretty remarkable. That brings me to the first of the two major themes of Half the Sky. And the first is that, you know, it's not so much IQ that keeps a lot of these girls in the developing world in school. It's chromosomes. What chromosomes do you have? Because often the girls will get pulled out for lack of funds. And so we do think that the moral challenge of this century is gender inequity. In the same way that in the 19th century it was slavery, and in the 20th it was totalitarianism, we think that the moral cause of our time is the gender inequity. It's the brutality that so many people around the world face because of their gender. Now you may think, oh my goodness, what an exaggeration. How can you make such a claim? And at first I thought that that was an exaggeration too. It was too big a claim to make. But then I looked at, I'm going to burden you with another poll, another quiz. I know you just had a whole bunch of quiz questions there. But let me ask you this. How many of you think there are more males or more females in the world today? Okay, let's take a poll. How many of you think there are more males in the world today? Raise your hands. Okay, a few. How many of you think there are more females in the world today? Raise your hands. The majority of you. Well, in fact, the majority of you are wrong. Yes, I know, it sounds very strange. Here in the U.S., in Europe, you know, when we have male and females have equal access to food, healthcare, well, you know, there are more females in the world because we live longer. That's not true in the rest of the world, particularly the developing world. In fact, there's been some amazing research by Amartya Sen, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics. He and his demographers did some remarkable, statistical analysis about the world population, and they discovered that there are anywhere between 60 million and 100 million missing females in the current population. Missing females. Just take the smaller number, 60 million. That is the size of Germany. And look at what an economic powerhouse that is. You see the implications. It's huge. It also tips the global population, the balance of male-female around the world, so that there are more males in the world. So it is stunning. But that brings me to the next of the two major tenets of Half the Sky. And so let's put aside the right and wrong of it all. Let's put aside the moral issue. If we were just to look at the practical issue, we think that one of the major ways to bring about growth and to bring about and to really address sometimes even things like terrorism is to educate girls and to bring women into the formal labor force. So basically, when you think about it, it's school and jobs. It's what we here all care about. It also is true of those in the rest of the world, in the developing world. So, you know, how does educating a girl, you know, help with poverty? Well, you know, as you saw with Daimanju, when you educate a girl, you know, she actually, you sort of help a village. Maybe it's the maternal instinct, they don't really know, but they actually see that it has a profound effect. One of the biggest effects has to do with overpopulation at the micro level. So, for instance, when you educate a girl, she tends to get married later on in life, she tends to have kids later on in life, and she tends to have fewer kids. And when she does raise those fewer kids, she tends to raise them in a more enlightened way because of her education. So that has a profound effect. It's happened generation after generation. We saw it happen actually here in the U.S. as well. Remember all those larger families, you know, a century ago. And that's true. We've seen it happen in the developing world as well as countries move up the economic ladder. The second thing is that, you know, women also can become part of the solution. We often tend to think of them as a problem. Oh, it's a problem with all these women who are uneducated. But actually, they can be really part of the solution. The other reason has to do with, it's something that Bill Gates said as he was touring Saudi Arabia. And he was speaking to an audience very much like yourselves. There was one major difference, though. So on this side, there was all men. On this side was all women. They were covered, Saudi Arabia after all, and there was a physical barrier. So there was just no way that the males could see the females. Someone from this side, a man, stood up and said, "Mr. Gates, we have here in this country the goal to become one of the top 10 countries when it comes to growth. Do you think we'll make it?" And as he stared out at the crowd, he said, "You know, if you're not fully utilizing half the talent in your country, there is no way you'll get near the top 10. So what does an agenda look like? What are some of the top issues facing women when it comes to society when it comes to gender inequity? I'd say one topic that probably some of you have heard about is trafficking. You know, sex trafficking, whatever you want to call it, it is a global problem, and it's actually also come to the shores of the U.S., or at least it has surfaced more in our in the public sphere. What actually is it? If you look at, take Cambodia for an example, what tends to happen is a young girl, she could be 11, 12, 13, even younger, often gets kidnapped from a remote place where she lives. It's usually a very remote village, and she's not very well educated, and she's sold to a brothel where she is forced to work 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. She's not paid a dime, and she often isn't even fed that much because they don't want her to get fat. What does that look like? Well, it looks like slavery. Let's compare it to slavery as we know it in this country. Just a very simple comparison. If you look at the peak of the slave trade in the U.S., in the 1770s and 1780s, there were about 80,000 slaves transported from Africa to the New World each year. Now, and there were some statistics that are very difficult to come by because our borders are much more porous, but the State Department did one estimate, and they found that across international borders, there were 800,000 people who had been trafficked across international borders, many of them for sex. And that doesn't even include those who are trafficked within their borders, within Cambodia, for instance. And so, you know, that's a really amazing figure. The other comparison is the value of a slave during the times of slavery here in the U.S. If you actually gross that dollar amount up, accounting for, the inflation and whatnot, that slave has a value of about $35,000 to $40,000, which is real money. That's real money. You know how much these girls go for? As little as $300, which, why is that so devastating? It's because it means that she's utterly disposable. So if she resists, they beat her up, or if she, really puts up a fight, they get rid of her. I mean, they could kill her. They could actually really reduce her to nothing. And so it becomes much more insidious. So that is the problem. Now, it is also happening here in the U.S., and I want to tell you the story of one woman named Shauna who it's a phenomenon that really is here, existing here in the U.S., and hopefully it's not here in Lincoln, but it is in places, where we don't expect it. So Shauna actually is in Nashville. She was born with blonde hair, blue eyes, and heroin in her system. Her mother was a drug addict, and would often trade sex for drugs. And when Shauna was 13 years old, her mother took Shauna to a customer's home because obviously she was going to try and, you know, have her work. And Shauna was very frightened. She had no idea what she was supposed to do. And she got very nervous and resisted. And her mother shot her up with heroin. And Shauna just remembers falling back onto the waterbed, and that was her initiation into prostitution. So that was her life. So Shauna then had her pimp, Nitty, who, you know, commanded what she did, took every single penny from her. She never had a penny of her own. He took all of the money. He told her where to go. He branded her, actually, in the way that you brand cows, which I know you all are familiar with here. But she got branded too. And so by the age of 35, she trusted no one. She had been arrested 167 times. Her pimp, zero. So this is Shauna, the life that she had to live, you know, as someone who had been trafficked was, you know, is pretty miserable. So this is something that is very real, you know, in our society as well. The next issue on the agenda that I want to talk about is maternal mortality. And it is the maternal mortality has such numbers that over the years it really has helped contribute to this 60 million missing females in the global population. Look, everyone here in the U.S. and in Europe, when there is a birth, we celebrate it. It's something we look forward to. In a place like Niger, 1 in 7 women can expect to die sometime in their lifetime from childbirth. We know it's not rocket science. It's just political will. We know what it takes to allow women to deliver smoothly. It's just simple, basic health care. But that is so non-existent in a lot of these places, partly because these women have three things not going for them. They are poor, they are rural, and they are female. Now, if you actually just look at the women who do survive, for every woman who dies in childbirth, there are 20 who survive, but with some serious injury from childbirth, some serious injury. And one of the most devastating injuries is obstetric fistula. How many of you have heard of obstetric fistula? Good, okay. So you know what happens. It's basically a woman has obstructed labor, and there's a puncture in her bladder, and so there's a lot of leakage. Let me tell you the story of Mahabuba. Mahabuba was 13 when she got married against her will, and she got pregnant against her will. She lives in Ethiopia. She ran out to the bush, basically. She was so young. I mean, her body was also immature. She was so young. She ran onto the bush to have the baby. She had obstructed labor. The baby died, and she ended up with a fistula. Well, she had no idea what was happening, but she couldn't control herself. She couldn't control her wastes. And so she stank. The villagers didn't know what happened to her. They thought she was cursed. And they thought, what are we going to do with her? So they found a hut at the edge of the village. And they ripped off the door so that the hyenas would get her at night. That night, Mahabuba found a stick in the hut. And she fought off those hyenas with that stick the entire night. She was 14 years old. And then the next morning, she knew that there was a foreign missionary in the nearest village. If she could just get to him, he'll know what to do and he'll help her. Well, so she had some damage to her inside, so she couldn't really walk. So she dragged herself to the nearest village. And, you know, at night, she would climb up the trees and spend the night there to avoid the hyenas again. The reason she spent so many nights in the trees was that that village was 30 miles away. So Mahabuba, she made it. She made it to that missionary's doorstep. He took one look at her. He knew exactly what had happened. He rushed her off to the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital. And you know, she was repaired in a series of operations. 300, 400, 500, several hundred dollars. That's what it was, and she was repaired. And as she was recovering, the doctors noticed this girl, yes, she's made of steel. She survived. But not only that, they saw that she was clever. So they made her a nurse at the hospital. So she is giving back. She's helping thousands of girls who are in her situation. And she's, again, part of the solution, not the problem. She is now in a virtuous cycle, not a vicious cycle. And her friend, who, very similar story to Mahabuba, but she also, the doctors noticed that she was very good with her fingers, but totally uneducated. But she now helps with the surgeries because she is so good with her fingers that she helps the doctors with the surgeries. Again, they found a woman who is part of the solution now, no longer part of the problem. So it is important to see that women can become part of the solution. And I've given you a hint about how some of that happens. There are also more general areas where you really can bring women in as part of the solution. It tends to work to help, in areas of health, in areas of financial empowerment, and in education. So what happened with Shauna? Shauna actually was helped by a woman named Becca Stevens, who is a chaplain at the at Vanderbilt University. She noticed there were a lot of women who were being trafficked, and she wanted to help out. And so she formed this program called the Magdalene Program, where she has a safe house where all these women are brought, people like Shauna are brought to, and she basically detoxes them. She brings in doctors to examine them, and Shauna was actually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress syndrome. So she was really like fighting a war all her life. It was like living in a war. And then she also had another doctor sort of remove a lot of the tattoos. And so now, Shauna was much better physically. And then she had to find a purpose in life. And so Becca Stevens formed this enterprise called Thistle Farms, where the girls who are able to make it through her program can actually find a job. And so Thistle Farms makes soaps, scents, crafts, candles, and they sell them at places. They make them, they design them, and they sell them. And so Shauna actually was put into the sales department, and it turned out that she was a brilliant saleswoman. She actually is, she's a fiery woman. She actually probably, wears down the stores that actually she's trying to sell to. And in fact now, Thistle Farms products is being sold at Whole Foods. So if you ever see some products, some soaps and at Whole Foods that are made by Thistle Farms and you buy some, you're supporting people like Shauna. Shauna is really doing much better. She's been off alcohol and drugs for 4 years, and she also is giving back now too. She goes out on not quite raids, but she helps the police go roam the streets to look for girls who have been trafficked, and she has much more street cred with them to convince and persuade them to come off the streets and go into a program like Magdalene. So it is very much possible to bring these women into the solution again and not be just part of the problem. The other area that is really important is financial empowerment. And I know a lot of you have heard of things like micro-lending, right? You've all heard of micro-lending. There's another kind of microfinance, which is micro-savings, which is even better, which is even more powerful. And when it works, it can be transformative. Let me tell you the story of a woman named Goretti. So Goretti was living in Burundi, which is a beautiful, lush place in Africa, but it just happens to be one of the poorest places. So Goretti and lived with her husband, Bernard, and she had like 6 children. Goretti was not able to touch cash. She's not able to touch cash. It was a rule. And she also is not able to leave the house without Bernard's permission. It's kind of a custom that a lot of the women in her village had to follow. So when they went shopping for vegetables, Goretti would carry the basket. Bernard would go with her. They would go to the marketplace, and she would point out what she needed. They would put it into her basket. She would carry the basket, and Bernard would pay for it, and they'd go home. So Goretti had heard about this program in the village. It was kind of like a micro-savings program. She didn't really know that much about it, but she heard that there was a really good program, and she wanted to join it. And so she kept asking permission from Bernard, and he kept saying, no, 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 you know, you can't. Meanwhile, Bernard would go out a few times a week and drink banana beer. That's beer made from banana. And he would actually spend 30% of the household income on his banana beer. But he wouldn't let Goretti go out. So finally, she had to sneak out of the house. So she made him a nice dinner. She tended to all his needs. And then she snuck out of the house. So what happens in this micro savings circle is that each woman brings a dime. They all put it in the center. And then they lend it to one woman for that month. And this was a new group. And so they had to choose a president. And they chose Goretti. So here, Goretti is the president of a micro savings group, and she has never touched cash before. But that didn't stop her. And in fact, she decided to actually borrow the money. That they decided to lend the money to her that time, and she had to choose a project. And so what did she do? She actually took the money, she bought some fertilizer, and she planted some potatoes. And she actually had a really good crop of potatoes. So she was able to sell those potatoes at quite a nice price, and then she paid off the loan with interest, like $2.50 or some of that, to her fellow micro savings group mates. And then she had this profit, and she was thinking, what am I going to do with this profit? She was thinking, what can I invest in? She knew that there was one product that would sell well, that certainly sold well in her household. Yep, and that was banana beer. So she invested in a banana beer business, and it did really well. In fact, Goretti became like the local tycoon. She was able to buy, you know, a goat. She did animal husbandry. She's really blossomed now. And she also brought Bernard in as a partner, which was very important. So they are partners in this enterprise. They are together, the tycoons of the village. And when Bernard happened to come down with malaria, guess who paid the hospital bills? Goretti. So when micro savings works, it can work extremely well. I mean, it doesn't always work this well, but it really does work. And, you know, I do want to give you a reality check. It doesn't always work this well. Goretti's a special case because she then went on to become a role model for women in the village. She's coaching women on how to actually speak up, on how to actually do animal husbandry or how to start their own businesses. She's really become very active in the village. It's hard. Helping people is very hard. And there have been a lot of books written criticizing aid. A lot of development experts have been saying aid doesn't work. Foreign aid doesn't work. USAID gives about $500 million a year, and it doesn't give. It's only 1%, less than 1% of the GDP. It's not a huge amount, as some people think. And they've improved their methods over the year, but you know, people have criticized aid programs, and they have a certain legitimacy there. Aid is very. It's not always done well. It's not always. The programs are not always implemented well. There's also corruption. So it is hard to find, you know, a preponderance of success stories. But there are success stories. And sometimes aid is not very sexy either. We often think, oh, it would be nice to have, to build a school and have our name written on it. University of Nebraska donors, right? That is good. And we need to build schools, and it's really important to build schools in Tanzania or in Uganda or in Kenya. But you know something that's even more effective? It's not what you think. Deworming pills. Now, how sexy is that? How many of you have heard of deworming pills? What they are is that there are a lot of kids, they're eating dirty food. And they're getting intestinal worms. And what happens, and girls are especially vulnerable, they get intestinal worms, and then the worms basically suck the nutrients from the kid. She gets anemic. She can't concentrate in school. She can't do her homework. She starts to drop out. So it's this vicious cycle where you want to keep the girls in school, but you know this is what's obstructing them from staying in school. So if you give them a pill, you know, every year, then you can actually deworm them, and they're more likely to actually absorb their own nutrients and to stay healthy and to work and function more effectively at school. And you know, building schools is very important. You need schools. It's about $100 per extra marginal student that you keep in school with building schools. But deworming kids, it's about a few dollars. It's much cheaper, and it also works. So you need both, but there are sometimes things that you can do that are far more cost-effective that, unfortunately, are not sexy. So we also know that it's hard to talk about things like deworming pills. I mean, you know, you can't really go up to your friends and say, hey, have you gotten the latest on deworming pills? It's not really very interesting. So we want to reach people in ways that they are reached. We also know that book reading is not America's favorite pastime. So we also thought a documentary would work. So I'd like to show you a trailer from the documentary. Well, actually, before I do that, I want to give you one last example of the third area that I mentioned, which is education. So I talked about Daimaju. And it is not just Asia where education works. It's also in Africa, in South America, but particularly in Africa where it is so important to build education and to give kids an education. Let me tell you the story of Beatrice Bura. Beatrice was 9 years old. She lived on the border, inside Uganda along the border, and she had never been to a lick of school. And her parents again said, you know, this is too expensive, we can't afford it, you know, you're also a girl, we're not going to send you to school. Well, there's an organization based in Arkansas called Heifer International, and they happened to send two goats to the village in Uganda where Beatrice was raised, and one of those goats went to Beatrice's parents. So the goat had twins and started producing milk, and they found that they can also sell the milk. So they started selling the milk. They had a lot of milk. They started selling a lot of the milk, and the cash started pouring in. And then they realized that they actually had enough money to send Beatrice to school. So here's Beatrice at 9 years old, and she was going to school with, you know, the first graders, but that was okay. She was just delighted to be at school. In fact, she rocketed to the top of her class. She stayed at the top of her class in elementary school, in middle school, in high school, and then she scored brilliantly on the national examinations that she actually was able to secure a place at a college here in the U.S. A few years ago, Beatrice graduated from Connecticut College. You know, and on her celebration day, she said, this is the best day of my life because of a goat. It truly was. I mean, you think of these programs, you hear about Heifer International, but they really can make a difference in a life. And what's important about these programs like Heifer is that they also teach you how to fish rather than give you a fish. And that's what's important. Sustainable solutions is what the world is looking for, not just handouts, not just aid. It really is looking for sustainable solutions. So now I can get you to the documentary that we did that actually shows a lot of the challenges that women are facing around the world.
The issue of gender equality globally must be addressed if the problems that we share across the world are to be solved.
It's the way that we can bring greater peace and balance in this world.
We're at the point of freedom, and that means two things. One is it's maximum danger, and the other is we're not going to stop.
What Nick and Cheryl have been able to do is tell very compelling stories
of people that they empathize with and understand in their context.
Well, I got an email. I remember like the subject being like Sierra Leone, and I opened that one because I was like, oh, that's interesting. What's that all about? And then it was the invitation to come on board, and I immediately said yes. I love what Nick and Cheryl say in the book, that women are not the problem, they're the solution.
When I started reading what Half the Sky is about and what the message is and the story.
You are so beautiful and so smart. I know you will be very successful.
You can't say no.
Maybe I shouldn't ask, but can I ask, did your husband ever hit you?
No. Because I'm very harsh.
Nick and Cheryl kind of revolutionized the way people talk about aid and made people very fired up and inspired, and certainly made me want to get out there and be a part of the movement.
So you were a commercial sex worker from when to when?
From 94 to 98.
I'm just curious how much you were paid for that work.
50 shillings.
It's a tough topic. The challenge that women and girls face around the world is not an easy topic to talk about, but we really think it is the moral challenge of this century.
Nick and Cheryl are out there talking about this issue, and not just talking about it kind of theoretically, but they have all these stories about actual girls and women that are going through some of these struggles. That really brings it to life for a much wider audience.
As long as the victims are poor, rural, female, illiterate, they don't have voice.
Don't want to forget that.
To be physically present in a place is irreplaceable. Nicholas is right. You have to show up.
Yeah. She's fine.
She is fine.
Okay. This is like a war map, a strategic map. Where do we need someone to fight the enemy? She doesn't have a radial pulse. Disease, death.
Celebrities can bring these issues into the limelight. That's just a no-brainer. That's your job, you know, to shine a little light on people that are actually doing the hard lifting.
Mike, that one I told you, it's been so.
But from a brothel or from...
From a brothel.
You can't come up with something more beautiful than a young, innocent girl. And to inflict that experience on that human being is unspeakably cruel.
So she had to have like 10, 12 plans a day. If she don't want it, they beat her. I want to empower the survivor to stand up and say no. If they want to say no.
Three-year-old.
It's a three-year-old girl who has been raped, and she's just come back for follow-up. Yeah.
We shouldn't allow the violence that has been inflicted on women to continue. It must stop, because it can't stop. And they need to be part of the solution.
Stay safe, okay?
Sometimes the problem feels so big that changing one life doesn't feel like enough. But it is.
So every person, every corner of this world needs to raise a voice and say this has to stop.
This is not rocket science. This is not a problem that is unsolvable, that we have to invent something new. It just takes political will.
The rights we want to choose our husbands. We want to own the land. We want to go to school. We don't want to be cut anymore. We want also to make decisions. We want to participate in politics, to be leaders. We want to be equal.
The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. If we are going to see real development in the world, then our best investment is women.
So there are some things that you actually can learn abroad, and it helps you here solve similar problems. And so I want to talk about just one very briefly, which has to do with a very controversial topic, potentially, affirmative action for women. So, you know, there is a brilliant economist, Esther Duflo at MIT, who won the Clark Medal, which is the best economist under 40. And a few years ago, India mandated that one-third of all of their village chiefs had to be women. They just mandated that. And so they had a chance to do a huge sample to examine what happens when women become village chiefs. And so they looked at the first generation, and they saw that there was a huge amount of criticism of the women. Hypercriticism. I mean, they were uneducated, they didn't know anything, they were inexperienced. But when the researchers examined the performance of this first generation of women, they saw that on balance compared to the men, they were only slightly better. I mean, they... only slightly better. I mean, they did help with things like clean water for the village because they cared about that. They knew from their own experience at home that the families need to have clean water. They were less corrupt, but they also were less experienced and less educated. So on balance, they were only slightly better. But there was just hypercriticism. The villagers all thought that these women were really bad as village chiefs. They just did not do well. The second generation, researchers examined how the women village chiefs were. And the second generation, they found again that they were only slightly better. On balance, they were still inexperienced, still sort of less educated, but they did help with practical things like, you know, getting good water. On balance, they were only slightly better. But the villagers, the perception were that, oh, these women were actually quite fine. I mean, they were, you know, no different from men. They actually did a fine job. So it was very interesting to see that the negative bias in the very beginning had gone away. And so the question is whether or not affirmative action could actually speed up the disappearance of the negative bias in the beginning. So that's just something to think about as to whether or not it makes sense to have affirmative action policies for women. Just a thought. But then I want to close on this, on two things. On basically the question of, you know, why should you join in a movement to make things better? I mean, talking about conceptual movement because there's really no movement, but it's kind of join in a movement to help change the world and better your lives and improve society. What's in it for you? Why should you care? And to that I have two things to say. The first is that there are very few things in life, once we have all of our material needs satisfied, which all of us here in this room have, there are very few things in life that can actually raise your level of happiness, change your set point of happiness. One of those things is contributing to a cause larger than yourself. And the other thing, and I'll close on this, is a story about an aid worker in Darfur. This woman was strong and steadfast. She saw things that no human being should see. But she never broke down all her time in Darfur. She was just a strong aid worker. And then she came back for Christmas vacation. She was in her grandmother's backyard, and she saw something that made her break down in tears. What she saw was a bird feeder. A bird feeder. And she realized that she had the great fortune to be born in a land where we take for granted food, clothing, housing. We can get all that for ourselves. We can even provide food so that wild birds don't go hungry in the winter. And she realized that with that great fortune comes great responsibility. And so, like her, you, me, we all have won the lottery of life. The question is, how do you discharge that responsibility? And so, here's a cause. Join the movement, feel happier, maybe live longer, and help save the world. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cheryl, for enlightening us, opening our minds, and being here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, Cheryl will take questions from the audience. What role does sex-selected abortion play in the missing female phenomena?
Yeah, you know, that does play a large role, particularly in China and India, because, of course, a large part of the missing females are from those countries. They have such large populations in general. In fact, in China, there are, you know, huge numbers of missing females, you know, probably, you know, several tens of millions. So they make up a large portion of that 60 to 100. When you got the ultrasound and parents were able to look at what the sex the fetus was, often in China and in India, they did abort the female fetuses. It's not allowed now, but they obviously didn't catch it in time for you know, for a lot of abortions. In fact, unfortunately, in a place like China, the ratio at birth of males and females, it should be 106 boys for every 100 girls at birth, but in China it's something like 117 boys for every 100 girls. It's totally skewed, and that creates a huge problem. In fact, there are more males in China now, and so there are a lot of males that will never be able to get married. They have a saying for it. They call them bare branches. I don't know why, bare branches. You know, and there are some kind of funny things. It's not so funny in the end, but really, they talk now about men, you know, several men sharing a wife, that kind of thing. All these creative ideas are coming up because they have a real problem.
Right. What is your measure of success for the gender equality and education movement in developing countries?
Yeah, that's... there are, the UN puts out a huge number of indices by which they measure, you know, the progress of countries. And, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but, you know, they have everything from, you know, what age girls actually end up continuing school in. So there are 60 million girls, you know, something like that, who are 50, 60, who are not in primary school and they should be. They look at, you know, by country, what level of educational attainment a lot of these girls get to. And so that's one of the basic statistics. And then there's also job statistics as well. So there's a huge, this is a huge area.
How do we get more men involved as champions for gender equality?
That is a great question. And so it's great to have you, Mike, asking these questions about women. It's really important for us to think that this is not a women's issue. This is a social issue. We need to change attitudes in society. That's why Nick and I wrote the book together, A Man and a Woman, because we really think that in order to change society, everyone has to change their attitude. It can't, if it's just a women's thing, then we sort of lost the battle already. We haven't even started. And you know, it's important just to look at, you know, people as human beings and have a greater respect for the rights of people as individuals. And so I think it's really important to to embrace men in this endeavor as well and not isolate them or alienate them. So a lot of programs that are, you know, being conducted, for instance, in parts of Africa where there are things like female cutting, for instance, they are trying to involve men in the process so that men actually, it's a very complicated issue. I mean, I guess the easiest way I could explain is that when, you know, in China, for hundreds of years, almost 1,000 years, they had something called foot binding. I don't know how many of you heard of foot binding, but they actually took a little girl's foot, they bound it. My grandmother's feet were bound. I mean, it's awful, awful practice. And it wasn't just a women's thing, even though it was mothers doing it to their daughters. It turned out that the reason this happened is that, you know, the men wanted to marry women with bound feet, and they thought it wasn't, a woman wasn't really whole if she didn't have bound feet. And so they had to, it turns out there were Westerners who were appalled at this practice and really started to overcome it. It's one of the few instances where, you know, outsiders had, you know, did a really great job. They convinced Chinese intellectuals to say, you know, this is a terrible thing. The Chinese intellectuals started saying, yes, this is a shame on our society. We've got to change it. And then they realized that that wasn't enough. They went to the local, there's something called the local marriage associations, who were helping broker a lot of these marriages, and turned out that they were pivotal. So when you convince the marriage associations that it was okay for men to marry women who didn't have bound feet, that's when things started to change. And in a generation, you had foot binding just disappear. So you really can change culture, and it can happen very, very fast, but you need to figure out, given the particular practice, what is the best way of doing it.
And Cheryl, our last question this evening, what can each of us go home and do right now?
Yes, well, you know, what I tell people is that you have to find something that you're interested in. You know, don't just jump on a cause because everyone else is. You have to choose something that you care about because that's how you'll get more involved and you'll be motivated to stay involved. Do it with a bunch of friends. Find some friends and talk about a few issues and then choose an issue together that all of you can, you know, join in together, maybe get involved in an organization and, you know, join that organization or help in your local community, help that organization build a presence in that community or help deliver, a service or you obviously there's always, contributions that you can make. But I think the key is just to take that first step because nothing happens if you don't take that first step. And to realize that it's just not a burden. And in fact, when you find that you take that first step, you'll find that, you know, it really can be very rewarding. And if it's rewarding, then you're happier. And that's what's really important in life. So thanks very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today we've heard a talk by Cheryl Wudunn, author with her husband, journalist Nicholas Kristof, of A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity, and, also co-written with Nicholas Kristof, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide, which was also the topic of her presentation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 23, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E.N. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.